numerous accolades and awards and much recognition for her contributions. Too many to list, but I'll mention the MacArthur Fellowship, very very prestigious MacArthur Fellowship in 1990. Also elected to the National Academy of Science. She's also been a pioneer in bringing this work to the rest of us who aren't astronomers, who aren't even physicists. She's made several films and videos that have been viewed by millions of people around the globe, and is a great advocate and contributor to science in general. So she's contributing to not only her work and her field, but the rest of science. And so it truly is an honor and a pleasure to have her here today. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Margaret Geller.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction and for the warm welcome. It's a great honor to be part of this wonderful celebration of an extraordinary beginning of an ambitious scientific institute. And I think all of you who are all Canadians can be proud of this remarkably creative testament to human curiosity. Today, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the way galaxies like our own Milky Way form and evolve. And it turns out that a remarkable process, the collision between two galaxies or more, is important in the galaxy building process. So I'm going to tell you what happens, or at least what we know that happens, when galaxies collide. A week ago, thinking about coming here, I read one of Lee Smolin's popular books, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity. And this book describes the state that we're now in trying to understand the fundamental physics of space, time, and matter. And one of his chapter headings I found particularly appealing and fascinating. It says, "The universe is made of processes, not things." And one of the things that fascinated me about it is that Lee, who's working on the physics of the very, very small things we can't see or touch, said this to mean one thing, and I read it to mean another. What he meant was that he sees the universe as a network of processes, as a network of information, and that everything that happens in the universe is, everything that we can observe is interrelated, and that no object that we see, we think, when we look at an object, if you look at this lecture and you think that it's not changing, but actually it's not the same exactly at the end of my talk as it is when I began. And so there are processes going on everywhere in the universe that we're not aware of. Now I, who observe the universe, I look at things, big things, and these things that you see in the image are two very famous colliding galaxies. But what I want to understand are the underlying physical processes, the underlying laws and rules of physics, and how they work to make the objects we see around us and to enable us to exist. So the views that we have of the universe, Lee and I, come from the very large and from the very small, and they're a little bit different, but you can see how they kind of mesh together. So let me now begin the story of the way galaxies collide. So I'll begin in our own neighborhood. This is a picture of the Andromeda Galaxy. This is the only galaxy you can see with your naked eye from the northern hemisphere of the Earth. This galaxy is about 2 million light years from the Milky Way. So that means, just to get this idea in place, that means that the light that left this object traveled for 2 million years, didn't hit anything, till it hit the detectors in the photo, in the CCDs that made this picture. And we receive these ancient photons, and they tell us what the universe looked like and how it came to be as we see it today. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Andromeda, just to set the scale. Andromeda is pretty similar to our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Of course, we don't know exactly what the Milky Way looks like because we live inside it. So it's like living inside this building but never being able to get a look at the outside. And so if we could go outside our galaxy, it might look something like this. And a galaxy like this, they're big. It's 100,000 light years across, so traveling at the speed of light takes 100,000 years to cross it. And the Sun lives in the suburbs of the Milky Way, lives way out here somewhere, if this were the Milky Way. And there are about, of order, 10 billion stars like the Sun, which make up this galaxy. But they're only a small fraction of the story of the galaxy. As Vera Rubin, who is at the Perimeter Institute and perhaps here, discovered, galaxies like our own are embedded in vast halos of dark material. More than 90% of the mass of the galaxy is dark, and we still don't know what it is. Now, galaxies come in a vast array of shapes and sizes. And like our own galaxy, the Milky Way, Andromeda has some satellite galaxies, and these are two of them, this guy and this guy. And they have masses about 100 to 1,000 the time of the mass of Andromeda. And probably in several billion years, they won't be around anymore because Andromeda will have gobbled them up and increased its mass, as I will show you later. Even more serious, Andromeda is on a collision course with the Milky Way. I wouldn't advise lying awake at night worrying about it, because you can if you want. It'll be here in 2.5 billion years, and spectacular things will happen, which I'll tell you about later. Now, what I want to discuss is how we understand the relationship between this galaxy, which is essentially the age of the universe, 13, 14 billion years old, and these galaxies. This is an image of a piece of the sky about 1/100 the area covered by the moon. So a tiny, tiny piece of the sky. And this image is, I think, one of the icons of our time. And why do I say that? Because this image shows us the limits of the visible universe. The faintest objects, almost every fuzzy object you see in this image, is a galaxy. And these tiny specks are galaxies just beginning to form. So these are galaxies which are maybe only a billion years old. So as I said before, as we look out in space, we look back in time. So when we look at Andromeda, we see it as it was 2 million years ago. These galaxies are billions of light years away. So we see them as they were billions of years ago. And in fact, by looking out in space, we can see almost the entire history of the universe to a time when it was about 300,000 years old. Earlier than that, the universe was opaque, so we can't see through it. As Steven Weinberg explained this morning, the Ural universe is very hot and dense, and it's ionized, so the photons which are traveling through the universe are tightly linked to this ionized matter, and you can't see through the universe for the same reason you can't see through the sun. Now, what do you see in this picture? I said every fuzzy object is a galaxy, and that this picture represents one of the greatest reaches of the human mind, 14 billion light-year reach. Now, another thing you can see is this remarkable phenomenon. We know that the universe is expanding, and the expansion of the universe shifts the light from distant galaxies to the red. We call it the redshift. And in this picture, which is a true color picture, you can see the shift. So these guys are red, and this guy is blue, and that tells me this guy is a lot closer than that guy. So the more distant they are, the redder they are, as a general rule. Now, another thing you can see is that these galaxies look a bit of a mess. They're not the nice, stately spirals that Andromeda is. So even this guy, I mean, knowing it's going to become a spiral, you might say it was one, but, you know, if you didn't know, you wouldn't say. And these guys, I mean, they're a mess. And interestingly enough, probably this galaxy is colliding with this one, and these two, which are more distant, are also colliding with one another. Now, it's a lot easier. These are very distant objects. So if we want to learn about this collision process and its importance, there are two tools we can use. Well, there are many, actually. One, of course, is that we can simulate the way galaxies form on a computer. And the other is that we can make detailed observations of galaxies throughout the history of the universe. Now, of course, we can't see the past of our own galaxy, but we assume that our galaxy isn't all that different from all these other guys, and that the past of our galaxy is something like when our galaxy was in its infancy, it should have looked like these guys. Now, the idea that we have about the formation of galaxies in the universe is that in the early universe, the universe was very smooth. The matter distribution had very small lumps and bumps. And gravity likes to make lumps grow. In fact, if planets didn't orbit around the sun, they'd all fall into the sun. And so gravity, one of the things it likes to do is make lumps larger and larger. And it does that with galaxies. So these lumps of dark matter grow in the early universe. And the stuff that we know of, the baryonic matter that we are made of, condenses into these dark matter halos and makes the first nascent galaxies, some of which we may be seeing as these faint, faint, fuzzy globs in this image. Now, the general thought is that the masses of the first galaxies that form are much less than the mass of our own galaxy, maybe a hundredth, a thousandth, or even less. And that what happens is that along the way, galaxies collide with one another, and they merge together, and they grow. So the general idea is shown. This is just a schematic of the way people think galaxies form, and it's called a merger tree. I guess to some people it looks like a tree. So this circle here represents a galaxy at our epoch. So the age of the universe being 13.5 is GYR, means a giga year, 10 to the 9 years. And so this is a galaxy. And back here, each of these little dots represents a galaxy lit, a low-mass thing that doesn't survive to the current epoch. And the reason it doesn't survive is that this guy merges with that guy. And there's the point of the merger, and then another one merges, and another one merges, and so on, so on, so on. And you can see all these little guys are merging. And eventually, you run out of things to merge with, and you end up with us. So the question is, Can we trace this process back in time, and can we learn what happens and what important effects it has on the way galaxies evolve? So now what I'm going to do is show you some galaxies in the nearby universe, which are in the process of merging, and we'll talk about their properties a little bit. And then I'll show you a simulation of how it works. So, on the left, you see a picture of the same galaxy that was the same pair of galaxies that was in the first slide. But in the first slide, it was exposed so that you could see the details of the main bodies of the two galaxies. Here, these are burned out so that you can see these amazing weird tails. So these are two galaxies. They don't look much like Andromeda, but these are galaxies, and these are called the antennae for obvious reasons. And these, so when people first looked at these, when they first found these in the 1960s, people took plates of the entire sky. So the Palomar Observatory, there's a 48-inch telescope there, which was used to photograph the entire sky. It's called the Palomar Observatory Sky Survey. And this survey really was the first basis for modern investigations of extragalactic astronomy, or astronomy outside our own galaxy. And there were a number of people who scanned these plates to look for the weird galaxies that don't look anything like Andromeda. And they were looking at them. I mean, some people like to look for regularity in life, and other people focus on departures or weird things that happen. And these guys focused on the weird things, thinking that there was no way you could explain odd-looking objects like this just by gravitational interactions. They thought there might be some new physics required to explain oddball objects that look like this. Well, it turns out that even before they started their work, they worked in the 1960s, but in the 1940s, a man named Holmberg, working in Sweden, actually showed that gravitational interactions between galaxies could produce these streamers, and that they occur just because of tidal forces, the same forces which produce tides on the surface of the Earth. The differential gravitational force, the moon on the Earth, produces the tides we see, the symmetric tides. And but people ignored that. Until in the 1970s, computers became good enough to actually begin to calculate it. And two brothers, the two May brothers, did a simulation of a galaxy interacting with another one. And they represented each galaxy by 120 or so points. And we know the laws of gravity. We know Newton's law. And they simulated the interaction, and look what they got. Perfect match. So they showed that, in fact, these tidal streamers, these odd effects, were, in fact, due to a gravitational interaction. Now, another thing that's interesting about these interactions is that here's the same pair of galaxies, and now this is at a different contrast, so you can see the structure of the two main bodies. So the streamers that you saw before come out of here, but you can't see them, because this is a different contrast. And this is the image that I showed at the beginning. And you can see things are all different colors. There are lots of blue knots here. And the reason they're blue is that hot young stars are forming in these galaxies. So these stars are massive. They run through their lives very rapidly. They only live for tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years. And they're very, very hot. So one of the things that happens when galaxies collide is that lots of stars form. So what we say is that the collision drives what we call a shock wave through the gas. And it compresses the gas, we think. And stars form, and you see lots of them, and you also see this red stuff, that's dust. And this dust, these dusty regions are associated with star formation, and also dust is produced when these stars evolve. These stars evolve rapidly, they're very massive, they end their lives in an enormous explosion, and it's in those explosions that the elements that we're made of form. So the one lesson to carry away is that galaxy-galaxy collisions produce these remarkable-looking things, but somehow star formation in the universe is connected to this process of galaxy-galaxy collisions. Now, there are lots of these objects, and they have all kinds of weird appearances. This one, I mean, you can make your own name, but it's called the MICE. And this is a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope with spectacular resolution. And again, you can see that in these streamers, here you can see the tidal streamers. They're very blue, again, because of hot young stars. And you can see the dust in the centers of the galaxies. And you can see this gunk, which is material, which is actually passing from one galaxy to another. This is yet another picture from a ground-based telescope. I don't remember which, actually, but I believe it's the one of the European Southern Observatory telescopes in Chile. And here you can see this galaxy still retains its spiral structure. Again, you see very blue in the outskirts, lots of dust in its companions. So this is yet another example of galaxies in the process of collision. Now, sometimes you don't have just two galaxies, you can have three, four, or five. And here's an example. And they all get to be a mass at once. So you can see these streamers, and they form bars, and there are star-forming regions in the outskirts. It's a real mess. And eventually, these galaxies will merge to form a single, more massive object. So this is the way that galaxies grow in mass. Now, one of the frustrations of working on galaxies is that you can't put one in your lab. And you can't even go visit one. So astronomy is an observational, not an experimental science. But with the advances in computing, one of the fantastic things that's happened is that we've become able to use modern computers as a laboratory. So we say, this is what we say, the physical laws that are discovered in places like Perimeter Institute apply everywhere and everywhen, at every place and every time in the universe. So, let's make a galaxy in the computer, apply the physical laws we know, and see whether we can produce what happens. Now, as I said, the Toomey brothers for interacting galaxies, they did this for the first time in the 1970s. Now there are a number of people who've made these simulations, and one of the most beautiful is done by John Dubinsky, who's working here in Canada. He's at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics down the road in Toronto. But this one is not 100 particles per galaxy, but 100 million. So that gives you an idea, a little bit of an idea, of how much computing has advanced since the 1970s. So let me see if I can make this go. So this is a simulation of what is going to happen when Andromeda hits the Milky Way. And as you go through, you might think to yourself, where is the Earth going to be in all this? And the answer is that the Sun, could be thrown out in one of these tidal tails. And it could be flung. Right now, we're 20,000 light years from the center of our galaxy. We could be flung to hundreds of thousands of light years from the center of our galaxy, maybe. And then we get to see it, or the resulting mass, from the outside. So if you're going to be around 2.5 billion years from now, it'd be a good thing to watch. So here we go. So these are two disk-like galaxies. They come together. The tides produce symmetric distortions. We have two dyes a day on the earth, same thing. Matter, as you saw in one case, rained down from one galaxy to the other. And what happens is that you see these things are flung out. There's a loss of what we call angular momentum and a loss of energy from the relative motion, so the orbit decays, and the galaxies stick together and make one grand mess, which doesn't have any spiral structure anymore. Would you like to see that again? Oh, it's not done yet. No, it's not done yet. Let's see. So here we go. Tidal tails. Matter rains from one to the other. And by the way, you're seeing this in 1 minute. It takes a few hundred million years to do this. Now, these simulations predict that when galaxies merge, we ought to see a mess. So if you look around the universe, we ought to see some messes around. And the question is, do we see messes? And the answer is plenty. And there's one. This is called the Atoms for Peace galaxy. And you can see that it's a mess. And that this galaxy, it's believed, if you make detailed observations of this, you can see the motions in it are chaotic. And it has these nice tails and this messy structure in the middle. And this galaxy is believed to be the result of collision. Another nearby galaxy for which there's a very beautiful image from space telescope is called Centaurus A. This galaxy is also believed to be the result of a collision between two galaxies. And I'm showing you this to show you this region. This is black because there's dust which absorbs the light. But you can see the blue light peeking out from the hot young stars that form, and these rings of, you can see these rings of hot young stars, which is one of the characteristic things that you predict in a collision. Now, the model that I showed you of the interaction only takes account of the things that don't interact. It's not the gas, just the mass points, so to say, the stars. I might mention, I forgot to say, that stars in the galaxy are very far apart compared to their size. So if people on Earth were distributed like stars in our galaxy, there'd be one person per continent. So when galaxies collide, the stars almost never hit each other. The reason they stick together has to do with this global dynamics, not with collisions of individual stars. Now, galaxies also contain gas, and what happens when they collide, we saw that stars form and the gas heats up, and there are some spectacular aspects of that, and let me say a little bit about that. Simulations have now advanced to the point where people can treat not only the stars, so here are some stills from another simulation by Chris Myos and Lars Hernquist of interacting galaxies, again with several hundred million particles per galaxy. So this is what the stars look like. As we've seen, this is just another kind of view. You can see all the tidal gunk around them and the mess that forms in the end. But in this simulation, they simulate the gas as well. And gas has the nice property that it can cool. So the gas, you see, the particles or the stars form these sort of gloppy structures, and the gas forms these very fine structures. So this picture corresponds to this. And the gas also, you see, gets very concentrated in the center, and that really occurs as a result of conservation of angular momentum. The stars and stuff are thrown out, and something has to flow to the center to compensate, and a lot of gas flows to the center where young stars form. So here you can see the condensations of gas at the center. Now, you can ask, from an observational point of view, does this make any sense? So the question we want to ask is, if we look at the distribution of stars in the galaxy, old stars, it ought to have this sort of more smooth appearance than if we look at the distribution of young stars, which are associated with the gas. So now let me show you two pictures of colliding galaxies, same galaxies. So on the left are two galaxies in collision. This is an infrared image, which traces the distribution of the old stars, stars like the sun. And you can see it's pretty, there is essentially no structure in this guy except for its nucleus. This one has a funny ring that we don't understand. And these are really very smooth. On the right, these are the same galaxy, believe it or not, exactly the same, taken in ultraviolet light, very short wavelength light, which enables us to see the youngest stars. As I advertised, there are these thin, you can see these star-forming regions in the outer part of this galaxy where you see absolutely nothing in the infrared. And here you can see the same kind of structure with all these blobs, which are each of those blobs is a region where you're forming thousands of massive stars. So this is an example of the way that we use these simulations coupled with the data to try to understand our network of processes which tell us how stars and galaxies form in the universe. And again, you can see the connection between the galaxy interactions and star formation. Now, when I showed you the merger tree, one of the things that was evident there that I didn't emphasize is that in the history of a galaxy like ours, it might have one or maybe two collisions with a galaxy of comparable mass, of another massive object. Like we're going to have one with Andromeda, which is comparable in mass to the Milky Way. But most of the collisions which occur over the history of a galaxy are with much less massive galaxies, partly because less massive galaxies are a lot more abundant than low-mass galaxies. And as I showed you, Andromeda has some low-mass friends, and so does the Milky Way. So Deb Woods, who's a Harvard student working with me, set out to look for some examples of nearby galaxies which have very low-mass companions. And it turns out, for a variety of technical reasons, they're very hard to find. And so here are some examples. So this is a galaxy, and that's its friend. This is another very weird-looking, irregular galaxy, and that is its friend. And this is a galaxy, and that is its friend. And you can see that this galaxy has these loops of star formation and tails and so on. And I would venture to say there's nothing else in town here to be responsible for this, so probably this small guy is responsible. This is another spectacular picture from the European Southern Observatory. So here again is a massive galaxy with huge tidal tails. And I believe this one and this one are actual companions of this, which might be responsible for this remarkable structure. This is yet another. This is a famous example. These are objects called M81 after Messier, who made a catalog, I think, in the late 19th century. He made a catalog of fuzzy objects. Of course, then people had no idea that these things were millions of light years away. And so these are 81 and 82 in his catalog. And this galaxy, you can see it's sort of a mess. It has a dust lane and so on. And people think that the star formation in this little guy is being triggered by its interaction with the big one. And not only that, but the little one may have some responsibility for helping to drive the spiral structure in the big galaxy. Now, let's zoom in on this M82, which is a small galaxy in the universe. This is a beautiful picture of M82, and the red here is an image taken in the H alpha line of hydrogen. So that's sensitive to the presence of ionized gas in regions where there had been supernova explosions. So in these small galaxies, what happens is that stars form in the galaxy, massive stars. They don't live very long. There are lots of supernovae, and the supernovae drive a wind. They drive gas out of the galaxy, and that's what this red shows. It's really amazing. And this is another way of seeing the hot gas. This is an X-ray image, which is sensitive to the hot gas. So you can see the emission from the hot gas, and it shows more or less the same thing with much less resolution. You can see that there's hot gas in the middle, and that gas is blown out of the galaxy in this process. So there are lots of complex things that occur along the way to making our galaxy, but there's good evidence that we really are forming large numbers of massive stars, that they evolve rapidly, and so this whole picture fits together. Now, I said that Andromeda, which is a galaxy comparable in mass to the Milky Way, will collide with the Milky Way in about 2.5 billion years. And the Milky Way and Andromeda will stick together to form a galaxy we wouldn't recognize, an amorphous pile of stars. Much of the gas will probably be driven out. The sun, for all we know, might be flung out into intergalactic space. And if there are still human beings on Earth around, they'll be able to observe some rather spectacular things. Now, it turns out that that's not all that's going on with the Milky Way. It turns out that right now, in our epoch, the Milky Way is colliding with one of its small satellites. And this small satellite is shown here. It's called the Sagittarius Dwarf, very unimpressive. This thing has a mass of maybe a billion solar masses, maybe, or had a mass of maybe a billion solar masses or fewer, much smaller than the trillion solar masses of the Milky Way. And this is a picture of the plane of the Milky Way. So this galaxy is being distorted by the Milky Way, tidally distorted by the gravitational field of the Milky Way, stretched out and ripped apart. And this is a schematic showing where it was seen. It was discovered by counting stars in this region toward the center of the Milky Way by these people, Abada, Gilmore, and Irwin. And now people have confirmed this with lots of other kinds of observations. No sooner was this discovered than groups of theorists began to wonder about the structure of our own galaxy and whether our galaxy, which actually in some ways we know rather little about, whether our galaxy contained more clues to its history of formation than we might have thought. So their argument was, well, we see a small galaxy being disrupted. What is the history? How many galaxies have been disrupted in the past? Because after all, why should we be alive at the time when the one galaxy is being disrupted? If it's happening now, it must have happened a lot of times before. So their question was, let's say we buy this idea that we call hierarchical structure formation, where we grow large things from small. So we start out with these galaxy lips. They collide and merge to make the big galaxies we see. Can we see anything, even within our own galaxy, which tells us something about that? Now, our galaxy, I just want this before I show you one of the recent simulations of that, our galaxy has a number of dwarf companions, and these are two. There are only three galaxies visible with the naked eye from the Earth. One was Andromeda, and these are the other two. And these are visible from the southern hemisphere of the Earth. They're the Large Magellanic Cloud and this wimpy thing, the Small Magellanic Cloud. And these things are a lot less massive than Andromeda. These are a billion to 10 billion solar mass galaxies, and there's very good evidence that they are, in fact, this one, the LMC, both of them are forming stars. You can see the evidence in the LMC, it's quite blue, and that there's very good evidence that the interaction with the gravitational field of the Milky Way is very important in their history. And they are about 100,000 light years from the Milky Way, and probably eventually will be gobbled up by the Milky Way. Now, the recipe, as I said, for making a galaxy halo, or making the big massive halo, but the stellar halo of our galaxy, is to rip up these little dwarfs. You shred them up by gravitational interaction. And this is a schematic made by Chris Myos and Catherine Johnston. And so you can see the little galaxy starts out, it comes close to the big galaxy, the tidal forces of the big galaxy sort of cause it to be stretched out like this, and it follows its orbit, and eventually it sort of gets shredded up by the big galaxy. So that's the idea with just one. Now, Catherine and her colleague, James Bullock, James Bullock was a postdoc at the Center for Astrophysics, and he and Catherine were working on this problem, and they made this very beautiful movie, which I'll show you, of the process. So in this case, this central thing represents an initial galaxy less massive than our own, maybe an order of magnitude less massive than our own, and what happens when as it gobbles up its smaller satellites. So each of these colored things is a small satellite ranging from 100 million to something like 10 to the 10 or 10 billion solar masses. So you can see how the first thing that happens is they get elongated, then in the center they get mushed around. You see these things getting elongated, these big streams forming, and that's it. So let me show you that again. And make a few more points. So you can see how they get ripped up. Now, one thing you might not have been paying attention to is that the scale is changing. So you can see these numbers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, which means we're moving out farther and farther and farther in the halo of the galaxy. So what happens is that early on, these collisions occur, and they make the inner portion of the galaxy. And as time goes on, the satellites that are farther and farther away, the collisions form the outer region of the galaxy. And you can see that in the outer region, if we look at the outer region of the galaxy today, we ought to be able to see structure in the outer region, because it takes a very long time for these things to get mixed up. Very long time. And part of the reason it takes a long time is that these galaxies don't have very large mass, and so the velocities within these streamers are very small, and so they don't disperse very rapidly. So what these models say to those of us who make the observations and try to interpret them is go out and look at the halo and see if you can find this residual structure. And there have been a number of people who've been looking for this in a variety of ways, and there are a couple of individual structures which have been found, but there isn't yet a map of the halo. So let me just tell you a little bit about a project we've embarked on to say something about the way that big telescopes are used to approach this kind of problem. So I saw this model, and although I only worked on galaxies outside our own, I thought, well, this is great, and it happens that we have an instrument with which we can do something about this. So a young fellow who's a postdoc at the CFA, Warren Brown, who also did part of his PhD with me, and these two young people got together, we put our heads together, and we had some long discussions about what could we look at. So Catherine and James used their models to make some pictures which could tell us something about what we might be able to observe. And these are the pictures which I need to explain to you. So you saw in the picture that the inner part of a halo forms earlier than the outer part, and you saw in the picture that the inner part gets its structure erased and the outer part still has structure. So this is another way of showing that. So here are cuts. These are just projections on the sky of the galaxy, and this shows us what's within a radius of 20 to 30 kiloparsecs. So a kiloparsec is of order 3,000 light years. So this tells us something about what's in the inner part. And in addition to having the distribution on the sky, we've also colored the particles. We make the color proportional to how fast they move. So you can see here the white have a large positive velocity, and the blue have zero velocity. And so these are the inner portions. And here you can see there's not too much structure. It looks really pretty uniform. But as you begin to go out, and you don't have to go very far out, you begin to see not only that there's structure, but the knots have a color. Some are dark blue, some are white. You see this stretched out thing, this kind of tail, which is blue, this is white, and so on. And as you go out, you see more and more and more structure. And so that tells us that if we can measure the positions and velocities of these stars, we could measure the history of our galaxy and how it formed. Now, there are different ways to measure the positions than to measure the velocities. To measure the positions, you take a picture, and you measure the longitudes and latitudes of the stars. To measure velocities, we spread the light out into its colors. So we use what we call a spectrograph. We spread the light out into its colors, and we look for what you would call the Doppler shift. So you know that if you hear a siren receding from you, the pitch drops. If it comes toward you, the pitch goes up. The same thing happens with the emission of light. If an object recedes from you, the light is shifted to the red. If the object comes toward you, it's shifted to the blue. And we measure these blue and red shifts to measure the way stars are moving in our own halo of our galaxy. Now, there are a lot of stars in the halo of the galaxy. And fortunately today, instruments on big telescopes have advanced to the point where you can observe lots of objects at once. So this is one of the most important things that's happened in the last few years in observational astronomy. And at the Center for Astrophysics, we have an instrument team led by Dan Fabricant, who's one of the world leaders in constructing instruments for telescopes that have what we call a wide field. So the Smithsonian, along with the University of Arizona, operates a 16.5-meter telescope. 6.5-meter telescope. I was trying to translate meters to feet at the same time I was trying to talk, and I couldn't do that. So it's a 6.5-meter telescope, so order 18 feet across. So I think that's about the width. Isn't that about, I don't know, something like about two-thirds of the width of this? So this is a large telescope. And the unique thing about this telescope, it has what we call a large field of view. So this telescope can look at a square degree of the sky at a time. So for calibration, the moon covers a quarter of a square degree of the sky. So this telescope covers about four times the area of the moon. And it's instrumented with a variety of instruments, including this beautiful thing. I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but anyway, I think it's beautiful. This is called the HectoSpec. It is a spectroscopic instrument which enables observation of 300 objects at a time. And it uses some very fine technology to do that, and I thought I'd just give you an idea, because you probably haven't seen any of the instruments of modern science today, and this might be a nice introduction. So this big thing is the focal plane of the telescope. So this is where the sky is imaged in the telescope. And each of these long things is a metal rod which has inside it an optical fiber, just like the ones that carry your internet traffic or your communications. Now, these are very special fibers. They have some special properties and to transmit light over a broader range than is necessary for communications. And at the end of each of these fibers are two things. One is a magnetic button, which holds the fiber down to a very accurately measured position on this focal plane. And at that position, we know there's an object because we took a picture. Then there's a little prism in here which enables the fiber to look up at the sky. These fibers are positioned by these two robots, Fred and Ginger, or maybe Ginger and Fred. And these robots position these 300 fibers in 5 minutes. Extremely impressive. And then we point the telescope, and the light, the light is carried. These optical fibers run 25 meters from the telescope to a spectrograph, which sits on the floor, where the light is spread out into its colors. The data are recorded on CCDs, and they come over the internet back to Cambridge, where we do what we call reduce them and measure the velocities. Now, I think that one of the things that's really amazing about this is that, for example, these fibers are positioned to a fraction of a micron. They observe objects that are billions of light years away. They observe objects that are trillions of solar masses, that are hundreds of thousands of light years across. So the thing that I find amazing about this picture is that we use some of the very finest technology that people have developed to observe the vastest system we know. Now, this object, of course, a spectrum is a spectrum, and an object is an object. So we can use this, and I'm actually using it, to do two things. One is to measure the velocities of stars in our own galaxy, but I'm also using it to measure redshifts of very distant galaxies. So the same instrument, this is another connection. So I've tried to say to you that there's a connection between our galaxy and the history of galaxies in the universe, and that we can observe something about the history of the universe. One way to do it is by looking out in space and back in time. Another way to do it is by looking at the halo of our own galaxy. But science is full of connections, and another connection is that we not only do we use the same physics to understand all these objects, but we also use the same machinery to observe our galaxy and to observe galaxies throughout the history of the universe. Exactly the same machinery. So I hope that I've made you think a little bit about the distant universe shown here. This is another image. This is called the Hubble Deep Field. And here again, you see in this small region of the universe, this region, I think, is a small fraction of the area covered by the moon. And again, each of these fuzzy objects is a galaxy comparable with the Milky Way. And the closest of these are billions of light years away. So we see them as they were billions of years ago. So I hope I've convinced you that there is a connection between the irregularities of the galaxies here and the history of our own Milky Way. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Many thanks for just a superb lecture. We have time for questions, so we've left for 15
yes.
minutes.
Well, we know the universe is expanding. That we certainly know. We have abundant evidence for that. And we know that the early universe was very hot and very dense. And now we know the universe is a lot less dense and a lot less hot. Not only do we know that the universe is expanding, but it appears that the universe is expanding more and more and more rapidly, which is a very big surprise and produces a lot of bizarre consequences. One example is that in the very long-term future, 100 billion years or so from now, we won't be able to see these distant galaxies anymore because the light from them won't be able to reach us. So that would imply this very rapid expansion of the universe would imply that we live at a rather special time during which we can observe the history of the universe, which is yet another puzzle in our understanding. Do we know the shape? We believe the universe is infinite extent. There are a variety of what we call topologies that it may have. But, of course, the problem with an infinite universe is that you have to wait, even if the universe weren't rushing away more rapidly, more and more rapidly, you'd have to wait an infinite time to see it all. So we are doomed to only look at a very, very tiny piece of the universe. And from that, we infer what the entire universe is like. Yes? Ah. So the question is, what happens to the core black holes when these galaxies collide? And I'm not an expert on that, but I recently talked to Lars Hernquist, who's at our place, who is, and they have simulations now which can look at what happens to the central region and the core black holes. And what happens is that when the galaxies merge, the core black holes orbit each other, and eventually the core black holes, it appears, coalesce, make a bigger one. So there are galaxies which appear to have more than one black hole in their core, and that may be a massive black hole, and that may indicate that they are the remnant of a merger not so long ago, and so those haven't yet merged. Now, maybe they formed there, who knows, but anyway, one possibility is that they haven't yet merged. But the idea is that they eventually merge. Yes? Well, the dark matter is important in, well, the dark matter determines the mass. It completely determines the mass. And the distribution of the dark matter affects the appearance of these tidal tails. So if you make different assumptions about the relative distribution of the light-emitting and dark matter, you see different things. So to take an extreme example, if there isn't any dark matter, then you can really throw the tidal tails out, right? And if there's a lot of it, it's much harder to throw them out. So they have detailed implications for that. Now, for what you see, we see only the stuff that emits light. Yes? Well, when they collide, what happens is that the resulting galaxy, the galaxy you see, is probably more massive than either of its progenitors. But initially, at least, it's not the sum of the mass of the progenitors because a lot of stuff is thrown off. Right? You saw those tails, and it takes a long time for that material to fall back on, and some of it probably even escapes from the local region, small amount. So, roughly speaking, at a sort of zero-order level, the mass that you see in the end is the sum of the two. But there's also stuff that's spread out. And there's very good evidence, I didn't show, but There are clusters of galaxies. In fact, I think I have some pictures. One of the things I didn't show is that galaxies, about 10% or so of galaxies in the universe, live in clusters of galaxies, which contain hundreds to thousands of galaxies like the Milky Way. And these clusters, as you can see here, the galaxies look different from ours. They don't have spiral structure. So this is the Coma Cluster, which is, how far away is it? All I can think of is its redshift. It's a few hundred million light years away from us, of that order. And the galaxies are all ellipticals. And people believe that the reason that the galaxies don't have spiral structure, that they're ellipticals, is that in these dense regions, many collisions occurred long ago, and the gas was driven out of the galaxy, and you're left with these star piles. Not only that, but the galaxies in the central regions of these clusters have very extended halos, which are presumably the result, they're sort of the leftover stuff from the collisions that isn't associated anymore with individual galaxies. And this is an example of one of these central galaxies. This is one near us. This is the central galaxy in the Virgo cluster, where we live on the outskirts. And galaxies like this tend to have lots of globular clusters in them and to have very extended mass distributions. But this is a picture of another kind of simulation of the evolution of galaxies in this cluster. And I show it to sort of answer your, so you see, there are lots and lots and lots of interactions here. Here it's not just two galaxies interacting, but many. And you see there's stuff splattered all over the place here, which you can't associate with any individual galaxy. And now there's very good accumulating, people have detected objects which trace this stuff that's thrown off. And so that's a very exciting thing, which show that indeed material is thrown off in these collisions. So people have detected objects which show this.
Is there a change of state, like less hydrogen, more oxygen?
Well, there's the universe. I mean, if you talk about elements, it's essentially to first order, it's all hydrogen. There's very little oxygen compared to hydrogen. And what happens is that the gas is blown out. So the stars stay there, but the gas is heated up and is blown out, or it's compressed to form more stars, depending on the details of the interaction, or it's driven to the center where it forms more stars. But the change is in the morphology of the galaxy and in the star formation rate and so on. So there's no change of state in the material. There's still dark matter, there's still stars, there's still gas, but it's distributed. It's completely rearranged by the collisions. Yes? I'm not sure I understand the question, but galaxies, let me take a crack at it. You can ask me another question if I don't give you the answer. Andromeda is held to us by our mutual gravitational attraction with Andromeda. So at the beginning, in the early universe, what happened is that the Milky Way and Andromeda began flowing away from each other with the expansion of the universe. But there's enough mass in what we call the local group, predominantly Andromeda and us, to hold Andromeda together, just the way the Sun binds the Earth and the planets in the solar system. So what happened is that Andromeda turned around from the expansion and is coming back toward the Milky Way. And so these clusters, the same thing has happened. The region of the universe began to expand, but it's so massive, it's like a little bound universe. It turned around and collapsed and made the cluster. And that keeps happening. Stuff keeps turning around from the expansion because it's held to the cluster by the local gravitational by the local mass condensation, turns it around and builds up the cluster. Is that what you meant? That's right. is expanding. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a local thing because the mass isn't uniformly distributed in the universe. And oddly enough, in an expanding universe, gravity also likes to make holes. So it turns out that both high and low density regions grow in an expanding universe. So what happens is that the dense region expands in a way a little more slowly. The stuff stops expanding and turns around. And in the low density regions where you don't have any stuff, these large dark regions that we discovered when we made our first maps, the universe expands a little more rapidly and pushes stuff out toward the edges. Well, that's known, as I said before, that we think we now know that very well. Not only will it expand, but it's going to expand even faster. So I think that there's really, when I started, I think that one of the interesting things about this, the future of the universe, is I think that the observations, the observed amount of material in the universe, has always been, throughout my career, and I got my PhD in 1974, certainly throughout my career and even before, when people tried to measure how much matter there was per unit volume in the universe, it was always low, not enough to halt the expansion. But there are the theoretical reasons for not liking that wide open universe, and so people kept pressing to look for more matter, and even though we have all this dark matter, they couldn't find even more of it. But now we have lots of mechanisms for measuring how much matter there is in the universe, not the least of which are observations of the irregularities in the 3-degree Kelvin radiation, the microwave background which fills the universe. And all of the different ways that we have of assessing whether the universe will expand indefinitely lead to the same conclusion. This is it. Our universe has one history. It's going to expand forever, and that's it, which is very unpleasant for some people's philosophical views. Yes. Well, that is a question I can't answer. You need to ask the people at the Perimeter Institute about that. So I don't know how. Actually, the hypotheses are many about the explanation of this rapid expansion, but I think no one really understands how we measure that it is. For the fundamental physics, I think that's something that's a hot topic, which no one really, I can't answer that question. You can get a job here. And yes. Oh. Well, the question is, with all the things that happen in the universe, what is the future for humanity? I can give you a short answer to that, which you probably won't find very encouraging, but I think humanity is a lot more dangerous to itself than the universe is to humanity. So I think that's pretty much what I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very well. Yeah.
I think you have some.
Yes.
So after you pack up, maybe we can go to a quieter spot and talk to him.
I'm a student of Bob Fields.
Oh, you are?
So,
Oh, nice to meet you.
Oh, there, I'm Peter Burnett.
Good to meet you.
Say hi when you see
me. I'm Peter Burnett.
Burnett. Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. And you're like humanity is.
Get it?